once I got a taste of that, like, oh, you could pay the bands well and walk away with a few a few hundred bucks, which, you know, at the time that goes pretty far, 'cause I've got like no bills, maybe a cell phone.
Sure.
And, you know, and I'm like the only one in my friend group who has a cell phone, 'cause I'm like,
Sure,
you know,
sure,
I'm
sure.
like, a, I'm, a, I'm,
All right.
a, I'm feeling like a professional here.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Cloud Machine Podcast. My name is Matt Landry, and in this 60-second episode, I'm here with Monk's Frank Bach. Throughout the podcast, we discuss his artist project, punk music, Sudbury, his move to LA, his work as a designer, Sunshine Shop, balancing career and art, skateboarding, culture, his origin story, the music business, and so much more. We also play the Dreamfest game. Thanks for listening. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Cloud Machine Podcast, a platform that allows us to learn more about the music industry through conversations with artists, people in the behind the scenes, music business individuals, creatives, and much more. This podcast is brought to you by Eights, a musical direction and playback company out of Toronto. Our goal with this podcast is to create a network and shine a light on all stuff that is happening in the music world, topics and realities that are gatekept, and the people and roles that may often be overlooked. This week, I have the immense pleasure of welcoming Frank Bach to the podcast. He is an artist, designer, entrepreneur, dad, husband, skateboarder, mosher, and much more. I know Frank through our mutual hometown of Sudbury, Ontario. And I don't want to spoil too much, but he played a big part in both the music and design scene in Sudbury, which to me is a vital part of the cultural landscape in my hometown of Sudbury. I also carried around his old MacBook Air for a while before I moved to Toronto. So please welcome Monk, aka Frank Bach, to the podcast. Hi, Frank. How are you?
Hey, doing great. Yourself?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good. We have much more, like many more connections than the MacBook Air, but a fond memory of meeting you at the old Rock on Durham for that MacBook Air. I don't even remember when that was. Maybe like 2014 or something.
No, that I honestly almost forgot about that. It's such a funny memory.
It's fine.
Many
it's
many MacBooks ago.
yeah. Probably 10 years ago. Let's start the podcast how we always start the podcast. Your favorite live show experience as a fan ever? Do you have one? Do you have multiple?
There's a couple. I mean, I used to be a show promoter back in the day, and there was one, you know, one particular, it was a house show with this little band called Attack in Black, and we did it in my parents' living room. And that was, you know, the floors got damaged and the drywall might have got cracked a little bit, but it was just one of those moments, like just pure teenage bliss. Like you just can't even believe you're standing there witnessing this. And that's one I look back on really fondly. There's another one in particular. There was this venue in Toronto called Anya's Cafe, and it was like a restaurant that would turn kind of like into a punk venue at night. Yeah. probably just a mom and pop business trying to make rent, you know. So
sure,
like,
sure.
Okay, we'll let these hooligans in here and they'll do their thing after hours. And I remember seeing this band Fucked Up from Toronto, and you know, this was when they were like really a sort of proper punk band, and not like they sort of went into more like experimental kind of hardcore route, which I also love. But it was one of those moments where I think my musical palette kind of like changed right then and there. It was like, I need more of this. Like, this is
right
what, you know, we would drive from Sudbury to Toronto and then usually head back the same night. And you know, in those days, it was like a 4-hour drive home. It's, you know, just a crazy like road warrior situation. And just, that's one, you know, it's in my memory box in my brain forever.
And I asked you this, and I know that, like, I mean, there's so many shows to choose from, I'm sure, like in your shoes in regards to a concert promoter, also just a lover of music. And of course you also see these experiences or these bands that like sort of change your life, like Fucked Up or like your musical palette, as you said. That's fantastic. Is there a campaign, or project or era, in your world, that would best represent your work? For those who don't know, your multitude of hats.
I mean, there was, in my last job, I worked at Headspace, the meditation app, and you know, they're quite a popular brand, like pretty loved service by a lot of people who use it. And I would say just like that run of about 7 years working on the Headspace app was probably where my career changed a lot, like pretty pivotal moment in like who I was going into that and then who I am coming out of it.
Sure.
And just being like having the association with that and being able to sort of put my stamp on it in a way like that, you know, it's not like one campaign, but I think it's one like chunk of time. Yeah.
One role.
Yeah. I loved it.
Yeah. That's fantastic. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a bit. On the podcast, we do a quote segment. Last year it was the Erica Badu quote that basically compares music as the art form and the business. And this year we do a Joni Mitchell quote. The quote is, cool. I heard someone from the music business saying that they are no longer looking for talent. They want people with a certain look and a willingness to cooperate. This is an interview with Robert Hilburn of the LA Times, actually, in 2004. So this is 20 years ago now. She says, again, I'll repeat it. I heard someone from the music business saying they are no longer looking for talent. They want people with a certain look and a willingness to cooperate. Now, Frank, what's your first instinct when you hear that?
Well, love Joni Mitchell. I think the quote's kind of like, to me, it's dated itself a little bit. It's very representative of maybe the time it was mentioned. I think when you said it, I was like in my head thinking the music industry has changed so much. It's like, I don't know, it's like barely an industry at this point. Like it is, I don't know that labels, for one, I don't even know that labels play that big of a role anymore. I think we mostly need them for distribution and everything else you can mostly do yourself. Like, why would you cut someone in on a big chunk of your income if you're doing music for a living? And the like willingness to cooperate, like in my experiences, labels would love for you to just have it all together before they even show up. And they just kind of like fund a little bit of it. And then guess what? You're going to have to pay it back anyway. So it's like it's not even a willingness to cooperate. I think they want to see that your package is like together and that you know what you're doing and you need very little guidance.
Yeah.
That it's kind of like on the musician now to figure that stuff out before they even enter those conversations.
Yes. Yeah. The labels want to see, it's almost like you have to do it a year or two before the label even steps in, because they want to be able to see that you can even promote your own project.
Totally.
And it's kind of crazy because I've been having these conversations over the past few months, specifically on self-promotion and how labels have sort of only become, like you said, yes, a just distribution company, but also just like a bank. And how they rely on their marketing strategies, basically relying on the artists to do it themselves. Because TikTok is so like self-promotional, and the audience wants to see the authenticity behind the artist, and they want to be able to see it's like DIY without necessarily it being DIY. They want quality content, but they want it to be from that person itself. Anyway, it's like a whole thing.
Yeah, totally. No, I'm with you.
Yep. Yeah. How is, and you know, you've had multiple roles in this industry as an artist, but also concert promoter. We'll talk about design and posters later, but how is the business part of it viewed on your end of things, as in business sort of music industry? We started a bit with this talk about labels and stuff, but how is the general business part of it viewed for you?
You know, I think I might be a unique person for you to be chatting with, because I think most people you have on this pod are like pretty like integrated into the music world, and it's like it's something they're doing as a career, and I'm very much doing the music as a hobby. Yeah. And there are reasons why I did not seek to follow music as my full-time job. That, you know, there's two parts. One, I think I'm a better designer than I am a musician.
sure. Yeah.
The other side is it's really hard to make a living doing music, as many people know. And sort of relieving myself of that pressure to make a living with it kind of changes the output and the timelines and like the pace at which I'm making music and art.
Yeah.
But and yeah, I just, it, Yeah.
And I was just gonna say, and your process and the way you look at it as well, like your perspective on it completely.
Yeah, exactly. And that's not to say I don't dabble in things that are, music industry. Like, it's just that I'm very lucky to have the freedom to do it whatever way I want to do it. And, of course, there's like contractual obligations and things like that, but
Sure.
those were easier to negotiate when, I kind of had the cards, close
Yeah,
to my
exactly.
chest. Yeah.
And it's almost even more punk to do it. You're like, you don't necessarily you have the support to do it, so you don't have necessarily the pressures of the music business to sort of push that art. And it just happens that that art is also just punk music, and in the well, for me anyway, from maybe an outsider's perspective, it's almost more punk to not care, but you don't care because you have a job. So it's like it's interesting.
I don't need to be doing this.
Yeah,
It's
exactly.
fun, and then when it stops being fun, like, or in moments where it becomes stressful, then I can dial it back and like take a break.
Sure.
But yeah, I do feel lucky for that. I think that's like quite rare to
Yeah.
find somebody who has gone so heavily into their professional career outside of music and still kind of have a musical hobby that is more than just like jamming with your friends,
Yeah.
like
Oh,
in
yeah. Totally. And this is why I wanted to have you on the podcast. It's exactly that perspective. Are you seeing some new developments in the music industry that you're specifically interested in, from your maybe your side on as a designer? We also didn't talk about that you're now based in LA as well. There might be some things that we're not seeing here in Toronto. Are you seeing some new developments that you're interested in, even just as a consumer as well?
I think the tours are getting shorter. There's a lot more like fly in, fly out kind of stuff. Whereas when I was younger, if you had a show in Vancouver, you would literally start in Thunder Bay and you'd start making your way across the country and you'd play like 12 dates before you got to Vancouver. And when you look at the math on that, it makes like very little sense. But I think there's just, I don't know if flights got cheaper or people just got smarter or the time, we've all got other commitments where, for a
Sure.
few hundred dollars extra, you could fly out and play, play Vancouver, Victoria, Seattle or something and
Yeah,
just call it a
exactly.
day.
Yeah.
That's been cool. That's been cool to see. I really like that. I think there's a lot more like back in the day, the indie major label was like kind of where you wanted to be, right? Like a still
Yep.
independent label, but with enough of a backing that stuff would get into stores and you could get a good budget. Nowadays, I'm seeing a ton of really small niche labels that are incredible. Like there's a label out of the Bay Area called Smoking Room Records, and they do like Hotline TNT and Toner and these like really cool garage projects, and that stuff's like remarkable.
Yeah.
I think that's a huge way that music has changed, and they also seem to be a lot more like artist run. You've Changed Records
Yes.
is one of those where like it's artists supporting other artists, and I have no idea how they slice up the business side of things, but it
Sure.
seems to be working really well for everybody.
Yeah.
So yeah, the goal is not so much to like go so big. And I mean, I'm gonna kind of backtrack now too. With that said,
Yeah.
the idea of getting a big deal or getting a TV spot or getting a song in a movie, that used to be like really frowned upon. Like, how dare you? Why would you sell out like that? Now it
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if it's the social media aspect of things, but it's almost like selling out's almost like the goal these
Yeah,
days.
sure. Yeah. Yeah. Well, even just from a revenue perspective, because it's almost one of the only things to do, basically,
Totally. Like
to make that money now. Yeah.
the venues are in your merch cuts, the gas is
Yeah.
expensive. And it's like, yeah, Turnstile, please do the Blink tour and do the Taco Bell commercial. If you can continue making music,
Yes.
I think that's the way to go. Like everyone has to make a living at some point, and we all sort of sell our souls in a small way to exist. So if you can
Yeah.
do it playing music, that's incredible. I think that's a bit of a maturity in just people and in the industry realizing, unless you want to like live at mom and dad's house into your 30s and 40s, you're going to have to like get used to selling yourself a little bit more.
Yeah. And fans also being okay with that too. It's like, okay, like,
absolutely.
Like you said, like Turnstile, okay, maybe they're doing the Taco Bell commercial, but they can be on tour as well.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
In regards to like the fans are okay with that because they can also see them in their own town, like in a few weeks or whatever, you know,
it's like, yeah, 100%.
Let's talk about the origin story here. You know, sort of share the hometown, but even more than that, can you give me the lowdown on, sure, where you're from, but also your creative upbringing, family, friends, sure. High school.
Yeah, of course. I grew up in Isilda, Ontario, a little town part of Sudbury.
Oh yeah.
And you know, there's a few people in my family who are musical, but I don't know that anybody really gave it a full go at being a musician or really like does much of it these days.
Sure.
I think just like discovering genres like punk and hardcore music that are less, you know, they have a less intimidating on-ramp to get into. Started with like me and a few friends who wanted to write some songs, and I had never touched an instrument before, and they, you know, they were looking for a bassist, and you know, guitar is hard to play, drums are hard to play. We had a singer lined up, and I was like, I guess that's me. I guess I'll do like yeah. I'll play like the easy instrument. And I think being the like least talented easy instrument player, I started to find other ways to be impactful or like resourceful for the
sure.
band. And
sure.
That kind of led to me using what I was learning in school around branding and marketing and promoting things to like, I went to graphic design school. So using yeah. that to basically level up the band in whatever ways I could.
Sure.
And in a way, like making myself like irreplaceable, where
yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah. It's still what I do.
Whenever I talk about this stuff, it kind of feels like the nerdiest thing ever. Like people kind of used to roll their eyes, like, okay, like enough, you know, we don't need to talk about the Spotify plays and the, you know, how many back in the day it was MySpace plays.
Yeah.
And but you know, it is a part of your role as a musician. If you want to have any kind of level of success, it's really good to have somebody in your band who has their mind wrapped around the kind of more businessy side of things. And yeah.
And so at that time you were in college?
I was in college, yeah. Our band was called Vicious Cycle at the time. And you know, I was doing my best to make contacts with, you know, small labels and doing what I did as a promoter, reaching out to other promoters in other cities and starting small to like, you know, could we play a show in North Bay? Could we play a show in Sault Ste. Marie? And then eventually you get to, okay, we got a show in Toronto. We got Montreal. Let's make a weekend out of it.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you've got the, you know, the wheels are turning and things are really happening and you've got a stocked merch table and, you've got a real project. And yeah, that's kind of my approach. And all the while I was in college, in graphic design school. Yeah. And at one moment I kind of like the Vicious Cycle ended in a really uneventful way. It's just sort of like, wasn't even a big breakup or a nasty breakup. It just sort of like flopped. Like, you know, we all got to an age where few people were maybe moving out of town or deciding to go to school. And maybe we just lost the steam in the band a bit. It kind of felt at the time like you had to either go full time with music or kill it altogether. Where I look back and I'm like, why did we end it all together? We could have just taken a little breather. You know, we were going pretty hard. We were touring all over the place for years and it would have been fine to just take a year or two break or, you know, just a handful of shows a year.
Sure.
But instead it just kind of fizzled out and I focused on career stuff. So did many of the other guys in the band.
Yeah.
And, you know, it kind of led me to starting Monk today, where it felt in a way like I had an unfinished chapter in like my musical journey, and it was like, if I don't do it now, I don't know that I ever will. So that was
sure,
kind of motivating. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Early on, even if it's for design or music, do you remember of a story of something that happened that sort of changed your perspective on just creativity and the art, and also just like telling yourself, oh my gosh, this is possible, like as a career, maybe in design as well?
Yeah, definitely. There's a few mentors that I had early on, especially in design. Remember doing like a career day kind of thing, or sure, like a orientation day at the college I went to, Cambrian College in Sudbury. And the coordinator of the design program was showing packaging design for a light bulb. It was one of the exercises that the students did.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where it clicked. And I was like, oh, damn, I guess there are people who make this stuff for a living. Like everything you see on a shelf, on a magazine rack, there, it's all been designed by somebody at some point. Like some of it's good, some of it's bad, but somebody has designed that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was really interesting to see. And it kind of clicked in my head, like, oh, all this stuff I do for my band, like, album artwork and posters, there is like a more corporate avenue I could take and like still dabble in the other stuff. And I could sort of wonder if I could do both,
Right. And so it really came from music being like, hey, I'm interested in that. Did you go to school?
Yeah.
Did you accept or go to Cambrian because you were interested in the whole visual part of your band? Is that kind of why that led to going to Cambrian and doing that?
Yeah, definitely. It was like something I was already doing, and then discovering that there was a career path for people with my interests who liked who enjoyed creativity, who liked sitting at a computer for many hours a day. Like it's still fun for me. Like the time flies and I enjoy it.
Yeah.
So yeah, all those things kind of clicked, and I was able to use the computer like lab at the school to print tons of posters for free and make magazines and our use the screen printing studio.
You're paying
as well.
Tuition, why not?
It was incredible. And our profs were very into the band. They thought that it was really cool that we had this other thing going, and they'd even let me put posters up in the in the studio rooms and stuff. So it was
nice.
Yeah, it was a really all the pieces kind of came together at that time, and I could really see what the next kind of 10, 15, 20 years of my life would look like.
Well, and for me, I tend to think of my answers when I'm asking these questions as well. But let's say in some of the more pivotal moments of just, my creative development and stuff, like your light bulb, their packaging design for the light bulb. Yeah. After that, and I still do it today. If I find something out, I spend the next day or two or even weeks just researching the origin of that, who the person was behind that, album or package in your case. Was that like a process then? Was it like, oh my gosh, look at this packaging design. Okay, what the hell is that world? Like, was it sort of that like right away?
Yeah, definitely. Then I feel like I could look at the world differently and just sort of like have that curiosity around everything I was seeing. Like, oh, so who, I wonder who made that billboard? Who is there an ad agency who's making all this good stuff? How do I learn about them? Who are they? Can I get a job there one day? Like just the wheels were really spinning. And I remember having a similar moment when I was a kid, when kind of like when the internet first showed up in our house. Yeah. And I remember I had a skateboarding magazine or Transworld magazine or something. And every ad had a website on the bottom right corner. And that was kind of a new thing. I was like writing, I was like, 13 years old, writing down all the websites on a piece of paper. So the next time I got to a computer, I could go see those sites. And then that eventually led to learning how to code a little bit and learning how to do web design. And then that's kind of the evolution from probably print design, always being into digital things and wanting to just wanting to make want to make cool things with smart people, and
Yeah.
whether that was music, being on tour, or like a project for a company or an organization of some kind, like, you know, as long as you're surrounded by creative and smart people, then I'm having a good time.
Yeah. I keep on going back to the to that pivotal moment because it's very much like I've had those moments. It's very much like a quote unquote aha moment because you're like, oh my gosh, this thing is like designed by somebody and everything else is as well. So it's like it sort of it opens your mind to the world, basically.
It was literally a light bulb moment. That's the
sure. Oh,
yeah,
man.
But yeah, it was like a new, it was a new awareness that I didn't have. And I was like, oh, wow.
Sure.
You know, and if like, if these normal people can do this for a living, then I maybe I could do it too. You know, like,
yeah, it's crazy. Is there a moment that changed specifically in design, your design career? Is there a moment that changed things professionally for you? Maybe after school or something? I know I saw you on your LinkedIn as well. You would like all the work for 50 Carlton, a lot of the stuff, Beautiful and Sudbury as well, and all that stuff.
Yeah, there's a few of them. One was like shutting down my agency in Sudbury. That was like kind of that was a tough decision to make, but it felt like kind of felt like the best one as well. And even though it was difficult and, you know, look back on those days fondly.
Yeah.
Going from someone who is 100% entrepreneurial to like working as a senior designer at a company that was not mine was like it felt a bit like I was moving downward on the career ladder in a way.
Right.
Because a lot of people want to be self-employed. So they start their career off climbing the ladder. And then eventually, once they've got enough knowledge, they start their own thing.
Sure.
But just from there, like the move from Canada to California, for one, like just seeing the scale of the industry here, like between like LA, Silicon Valley, New York City, it's just at such a bigger scale than I was used to. And you know, living back in Sudbury, I would maybe have three or four companies I might work for, where you know, here it would be like, if you lost your job or you wanted to find something new, there's probably 400 to 500 companies you might work for. And you know, the economy just operates at a much bigger scale, and there's pros and cons to both sides, I would say.
Sure.
It can feel a little bit more transactional or a little bit like less homey here, but yeah, that was a big moment. And then I would say getting the job at Headspace to be a designer of the Headspace app, that totally changed my life. That was like, here's this thing I can like grasp onto and do like really meaningful work, be surrounded by this world of like wellness and mindfulness, and just like get super into that. And I find when you can connect your passion or something you're really into in that moment with your day-to-day job, like that's the perfect combo. That's what everybody wants. Like that.
Yeah.
You're able to show up and bring your full self to work, and you're genuinely interested in what you're doing. That's like, I think most people are doing jobs they're not really enjoying. And so to be able to be someone who has a job I'm truly enjoying and make a good living with it, I feel so lucky to do that.
Mm. Was wellness and mindfulness part of your life before you entered the Headspace?
Yeah, I would say it's what kind of got me the interest of wanting to work in a place like that.
Yeah.
I used to go to the Sudbury District Health Unit. They used to have a weekly meditation group session.
Yeah.
And I went there a few times. And at first I wasn't sure I was into it. My wife and her mom would go, and I would tag along, and I would, you know, sort of poke fun at it sometimes. Yeah, you guys can go do your funny little meditation thing and whatever. And I joined a couple times, and one day that also kind of clicked. It was like, wow, I feel really a little bit more clear-minded, a little bit more you know, just settled in my body, and like I can, you know, make better decisions, or you know, just generally feeling better.
Mm-hmm.
And there was also like the discovery of like there was a huge amount of meditation apps coming out in the app store. And I was a person who was working on stuff that goes in the app store.
Sure.
I was working on Red Bull TV at the time. And I remember using the Headspace app to kind of help with that transition of like, I'm going to make this big life-changing move from Sudbury to LA. And
right.
I'm pretty nervous and anxious about it. And like, it's super stressful and I'm spending a ton of money on a U-Haul and I need to apply for my work visa. And like,
sure.
what if it gets rejected?
Mm-hmm.
Then I've rented my house out in Sudbury. I can't go back into it. So it was kind of like this one way forward. Like there was no turning back.
Right.
And I was, you know, I was getting kind of freaked out.
Sure, sure.
I need
sure,
something
sure.
to like settle the nerves a bit.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's how I kind of got into the Headspace app a lot more. So once the chance to work there came up, it just felt like pretty perfect for me at the time. It's like I have this connection with the product and the service and I get what it does for people. And I
yeah.
have this design skill set that I can apply to that.
Sure. I was under the impression that you had moved to LA for that job. Like
no,
with
I
that
moved
job
to,
in hand kind of thing.
Not quite yet. It was about a year until that happened. I moved to
Okay.
LA to work on Red Bull.
Okay.
Which is, you know, totally different than a meditation app. It's like high octane energy
sure.
drink.
Yeah.
But you know, I grew up skateboarding and snowboarding. So like the world of Red Bull wasn't foreign to me. It was like just a little more bro-y than I was
Sure.
used to. But
Sure.
that was also a fun job. I mean, they have, speaking of music, they have the whole Red Bull Media House, which is
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
you know, they've done a lot of cool work with, especially in like electronic music with Red Bull Radio. And that was
Yes, yeah.
that was also quite a fun workplace to be in. Didn't last super long, but it did help get me, you know, get me relocated and sponsored my visa. So
Fantastic.
It kind of did what it needed to do. And I still chat with those guys
sure,
once
sure,
in a
sure,
while.
Sure. So if we go back a little bit, and I want to get the timeline correct here. So we talked about Cameron College Design School. We talked about the band. Was
Yep.
concert promoting before that?
Yeah, it was for sure. Yeah,
Okay,
it was
okay,
like
okay.
That moment, kind of between high school and college starting, and
Sure.
you know, dabbling around with Photoshop and making stuff.
Right.
When I had literally no clue what I was doing, but I kind of look back at that stuff and I'm like, oh, it's kind of like a purity. It's kind of cool to see what like the untrained
Sure.
like person makes.
Yeah.
And I think it got a little more refined as I like
Sure.
got to go to school for it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it just came from there used to be a lot of good like punk and hardcore and metal shows in Sudbury, just around independent music.
Yeah.
And I think it had been a few years where the all ages scene had not really been, you know, there was always stuff like at the Townhouse and all the like 19 plus bar shows, but
Yeah.
all ages wasn't really happening. And like almost just like a lot of things I've done in my life, I didn't really like ask permission to do it. I just sort of tried. And I think
Yeah.
a lot of people, I've seen that a lot of people think they need to ask permission or have someone ask them to do something before they try something new. And I've always just kind of went for it. And it started off as something really small, like, you know, a small, like 50, 60 person all ages show. My mom used to run a dance studio on Notre Dame,
yes, sure.
in Sudbury.
Yeah.
And you know, they had a PA system in there, like a really small one for, you know, for like rehearsals and stuff. And
yeah.
basically had two big empty rooms. You know, any night after 5 o'clock, it was pretty quiet up there. And so I thought, you know, hey mom, could we like, do you mind if me and my friends like jam here? And okay, yeah, so we started jamming there. And then, hey, we, you know, some friends would show up and hey, we could have like a little show here maybe. And it was
Right,
all like
right.
just on the floor.
Yeah. Was there a bunch of
You
like
know,
mirrors and stuff?
Yeah, I had lots of mirrors. Yeah. 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 So you're like
Probably
looking at
sounded
yourself.
great. Yeah.
Yeah, it sounded terrible. But it sounded terrible. But it was like pretty much free. And we could pay the bands pretty well. And
sure,
I was able,
sure.
I was basically able to make a living and like cover my school costs without having to get a real job.
That's
And
fantastic.
it was kind of the goal. It was like, once I got a taste of that, like, oh, you could pay the bands well and make walk away with a few a few hundred bucks, which, you know, at the time that goes pretty far. 'Cause I've got like no bills, maybe a cell phone.
Sure.
And, you know, and I'm like the only one in my friend group who has a cell phone. 'Cause I'm like,
Sure,
you know,
sure,
I'm
sure.
like, a, I'm, a, I'm, a,
Sure.
I'm feeling like a professional here. But
Yeah,
yeah,
and
that was that.
that's a
Once
business
you,
expense.
totally, totally. Once you, I feel like once I learned that you could make a living, or you could just like, you can make something and
Right.
exchange it for money, whether that's an experience, a product, whatever that might be. I
Yeah.
just carry that with me forever. And I,
Sure.
that's like, even though I work a full-time job, I still have that like entrepreneurial spirit. I think that, I don't know if it's going to go away. It's been, it's always on my mind.
Yeah, exactly. Can we talk about the importance of all ages shows for you in regards to why that was
Sure.
important for you? And was it sort of created out of a need?
Yeah, definitely. We were young, and we're living in a, you know, mid-sized city with not a whole lot to do for people who aren't going to the bars. And,
Yeah, sure.
you know, other than that, we were hanging out in our friends, you know, in our parents' basements. And
yeah.
So for us to even attend, it had to be all ages by
Yes,
default.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that, you know, giving young people access to something fun to do, I thought was pretty cool. And you know, I'd been through high school. I'd spent, you know, many nights drinking beers in an alleyway and then going to like the movie theater, you know, just like stupidity
Sure.
that like gets you in trouble and is like not that fun, just stuff you do out of boredom.
Right, right.
And so as I was getting a bit older, I thought, you know, I feel like it would be good for like good for a local community to have to keep contributing in this way. And, you know, giving younger people something to do. And eventually came a point where I got older. I was like probably in my mid-20s and I was still promoting the shows. And like, I was feeling like definitely the oldest person around and kind of felt like a time to, you know, pass the torch, so
Sure,
to
sure,
speak.
sure.
And, you know, I probably promoted hundreds of shows. I never once lost a dollar, which I'm very proud of, because I think that allowed me to have the longevity that I had doing it. It was about a decade. And I don't know that it's ever sort of picked up again in the same way. And I don't think it has to either. I think the world changes and, you know, tastes change and all
Totally.
that stuff. But yeah, I thought all ages, you know, that's always been big in the hardcore punk world. Bands like Fugazi, I think they would like only ever play all ages shows. There's still a couple bands out there that will not play bar shows just because they believe in like the accessibility of music. And I'm not that like intense about it, but I thought, you know, generally it'd be good to give young people access to this world, because it was pretty life-changing for me.
Yeah, fantastic. And is that where punksud.com came from? This is punksud.com. Now, this is past my time, so I don't even know what punksud is. I just saw a reference to that. What is that? Is that the concert promoting sort of platform, or what was that about?
So we talked about, you know, me learning to build websites and things, and
sure.
I guess that would have been my first sort of online community. And back at that time, online message boards were pretty big. This is like pre-Reddit, post like IRC chat. And there was already like a bit of a community around this like Punk Sud, like Punk Sudbury name.
Yeah.
But no website. And I thought, you know, hey, I know how to register a domain. I know how to build a little HTML thing. So I just spun up punksud.com, and, you know, on my mom's credit card for 10 bucks a year, got the domain, and
there
I
you
felt
go.
really cool and professional. And people were like, damn, this looks like, you know, this looks like a thing. Like, what's going on here? And there used to be these message boards. You could basically like a zip file you upload to the server, and it was all coded in PHP, and you could set up like different categories and little like areas for people to chat. So just had like our general chat. We had our show postings. There was even a, for a while, there was like a buy and trade So it's very like Craigslist, Kijiji, like, so people would be like selling amps, selling records.
Right.
One of like the little like marketing hacks that I discovered was I could put my, you know, there was a, quite a bit of traffic going to the website all the time because like lots of kids in high school and, you know, there was no, this is pre Instagram, pre social media, pre cell phone.
Right.
And, yeah, lots of like just daily users who are logging onto the site, like for the size of that. And it got pretty known in like high school circles. So you had all the like local community and even people from out of town saw like, oh, there's some like something going on here in Sudbury. And what I ended up doing was I put the whole forum in like a, basically a subfolder, and I made the landing page a page where I could put my poster for my next show that I had going on. So anybody going to the site would be hit with the, basically hit with the ad before they got in. So, you know, classic enter screen, enter button. And I honestly think that that helped a lot to build like the in-person community, because even if people weren't like that into the bands or whatever, and at that time there wasn't really a way to like sample the bands or listen to them either. So you just were basically like, hey, I see there's something going on here.
You gotta go to experience it, I think.
And then later came MySpace days, Facebook days, and I always had a few tricks up my sleeve for like how to promote in a more like automated way. I remember finding this very, very hacky kind of like MySpace auto poster bot thing that I think I paid like $50 for, and it would just post on people's comments section like whatever you wanted. So you could literally input like your poster, some kind of messaging, and just click go, and it would just run through your friends list and just bam 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 bam. In like 30 minutes I've posted the poster to like hundreds of people's profiles. And like, you know, and again, that stuff only worked for a little while. It didn't work forever. Eventually the sites get smart and they figure out like, this is kind of like a community guideline abuse of some kind, but you take what you can when it's available, you know, and just try to build upon that.
Yeah, man. You touched on it a bit. And you know, I grew up in a time in Sudbury that, there were some all age shows, but only for like a couple of years.
Right.
I guess my question is like Sudbury then versus now, we're both not living in Sudbury anymore. But what do you see maybe from the outside, in regards to Sudbury then versus now?
In music or just in general?
In general, maybe culturally.
It does seem like maybe 8-10 years ago, it had a very sort of like positive, feeling about it. Like the city was in its kind of in a change moment where, we had a lot of new like festivals coming up. Just the climate seemed very good and optimistic. And I'm not sure if it was probably a lot of factors, the pandemic for sure, one of them. The whole arena debacle like seemed to like really divide the city. And now it just sort of seems like, you know, we were on the upswing and we're like, it's sort of like teetering and starting to go downward into like, it's, I don't know, it's just not feeling like that positive optimistic feeling that I saw maybe a decade ago, and that's kind of sad to see, and I hope that it can turn around in some way. And I do see a lot of people who care so much about the community. Like there's still some good music stuff going on, and of course like the murals and the festivals are still happening. But I did at one point, I think I was ready to not be the culture changer and just wanted to go live in a place where the culture felt more like the one I already was trying to make, you know. After a while, I got kind of tired of sort of pushing the boulder uphill. It's kind of what it felt like.
Totally.
It's time for someone else to do that.
Yeah. Fantastic. I guess my next one is just LA, just moving away and LA, yeah. And it's a great transition there. So you started at Red Bull, yep. And then moved to Headspace. We talked about it a little bit, but what are some of the big sort of projects and your role there? Just to talk about that briefly.
Yeah, well, I worked on Red Bull TV. We launched it in all the app stores and on TV platforms. It was like mobile, TV. There's a web app as well, which is like redbull.tv.
Sure.
That was a pretty huge project because it was like basically 24/7 streaming platform, but also had like a Netflix style browsing discovery kind of thing going on. But we were one of the first, if not the first, to have a like always on channel. We're in a bit of a transition moment between like cable and satellite. You have channels basically.
Yeah.
And moving into like on demand, like Hulu, Netflix.
Sure.
But Red Bull was doing both. And that was a really interesting project in that way. And then I think I realized working on multi-platform is like has its own set of challenges, but the one I enjoyed the most was mobile. And
yeah, sure.
I like the challenge of like the small screen and it's like always in your pocket and you know, just having something there. And that kind of led me to Headspace. And I was also very interested in the fact that it's a subscription-based business. And like I try to take little pieces of things I learn in all my jobs and kind of carry them with me so that, you know, right now I work at a company that's more like an advertising based business. So that's like my first real dive into that, like advertising as the main revenue stream rather than subscription.
Yeah, yeah.
So just trying to, I guess, build up a bit of a repertoire of, I don't know, knowledge and experiences so that when I see stuff in the future, I'm like, oh, I've done this before. I know how this works.
Right.
I know how to design for healthcare. I know how to design for social media. I know how to work in the music business. Like, that, and it keeps things interesting for me as well.
Totally. What are some of the biggest challenges? Differences between advertising and subscription based? Because from what I see, especially in the design world, subscription based is interesting because you're getting people to the app. That is that's already interested and invested in the platform, and it just, it just like changes the way that they sort of interact with the medium, with the service.
Totally.
What are some of the differences that you see from your sort of chair, your sort of hat, on the design front?
Yeah, working at Headspace, we would have two major campaigns every year, and we tied those around because it's an app for like you know like becoming a better version of yourself or like finding like being more mindful.
Mm-hmm.
We found that a summer campaign and the big one was always the New Year campaign, sort of like a Christmas, New Year, new me kind of vibe.
Right.
And being that the app had a monthly and annual subscription, they make more money on the annual subscription than the monthly because it's like a one-shot, you know, annual sub. And even if the person only uses it for a month, they've already paid for the year. So we know that there's some predictability to the revenue.
Right.
And the fact that it's annual and meditation is hard and it's similar to like a gym membership where you have high intent and it's hard to make a habit of it. We called it lovingly a churn bomb, which means there's a time of year where your subscribers kind of lapse. And because everyone was coming on in like December, January, basically by October, November, the next year, you kind of get into a panicky state where you start to try to make things to keep people invested. So you're offering like a steeper discount or like building another feature. And that the fact that you're making money that way kind of changes what features and things you might build in the app. So sometimes this is like most common designer challenges. Sometimes you find yourself building things that are better for the business than they are for the customer.
Sure.
And that's like, you know, you try to balance it in the best way you can and kind of fight for what you think is right. But that's kind of the subscription-based model, especially on something that's people have high intent to use, but have a difficulty using. And then there's like advertising, which is typically around something that's easy to use, i.e. like a social media platform. Like people find themselves visiting them daily.
Sure.
Multiple times a day. And then so striking that balance between like, at what point does the advertising become annoying, or people don't want to use the platform because it has too many ads. Or like trying to make the ads more relevant or more, you know, more attuned to you. But then there's the whole other like back end side of things, which is you're not only building a platform, you're also building something that speaks to businesses where they can use it to promote their stuff, you know, restaurant.
Sure, sure. It's a tool, but also a platform, basically.
There's like customer facing side, which is what most people use. And then there's like the business facing side, which is how you pay for ads, and the ads keep the whole thing running.
Yeah.
Basically.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's such a unique challenge. I've also seen just from the design perspective, like making small tweaks on the interface of an advertising platform can have these really weird, like 2-3 months down the line side effects, where something appeared to be really good and positive, but a few months later you discover that that idea you had actually like dropped advertising revenue by, I don't know, 0.2% or something. At a certain scale, that could literally mean like huge amounts of money. Even though sometimes you might be doing what you think is the appropriate, like the right thing to do, you're answering a customer's problem.
Right.
There's these unknown side effects that you only really see once you kind of put that test out and see how it goes.
The longevity of the solution kind of thing.
There's lots of experimentation in both worlds, where you basically have to, you just have a hypothesis, you put it out there, see how it lands with a certain segment of users, and then you make a decision on whether or not it goes to everybody.
Mm-hmm. Great. How have these positions and your career affected your creativity? Not necessarily only as Monk or in music, but also I want to talk a little bit about Sunshine Shop as well. And
Well, the design at work I do for a living it feels more like functional problem solving than it does creative.
Sure.
And so like what initially got me attracted to the world of design was the creativity. And there's kind of like, I think there's kind of a scale where like the more there's like creativity on one side and like problem solving on the other side, or something else on the other side. And there are more people who want to do the creative part than the other stuff. So those jobs are like, they're maybe like lesser paying, or they are more flooded with applicants. And I mean, you kind of see it in music, right? Like there's so many people who want to be musicians. It's a very flooded market of like people basically willing to pay to play, you know, like that.
Oh yeah.
And so how that has affected my art is that I'm very cool with having a day job that is a day job. And then I find these other ways to sort of express that, you know, or like scratch that itch of the creative stuff.
Yeah.
And that it helps a lot to have these little side things, because I can, you know, I don't get as frustrated with my day job when things aren't, you know, as creative as I wanted them to be, or like maybe I had to make a decision that, or like kill an idea that I thought was really amazing. So I always have these other things, whether it's the Sunshine Shop or Monk as a music project. Those really feel like my own, and I can kind of do whatever I feel is right for those. So I think it's a good totally. Balance to have.
You totally divide it, sort of thing. Like this is the job. This is sort of these passion projects, creative projects that you're doing.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Fantastic. Can we introduce Sunshine Shop and sort of what's that about and where that falls in your creative mind map, your brain?
Yeah. So Sunshine started as basically me trying to make my own personal, like almost like a Obey clothing kind of for myself, you know, like I thought it'd be cool to have a bit of like merch, something to wear, something to sell. And I used to do a lot of design conferences, speaking engagements, and I kind of missed the whole like merch table aspect of being in a band. So I thought,
Right.
what if I could do like public speaking and sort of have a merch table? Like I've never seen that. Usually people have a book or maybe a course you can purchase or something, but
Right.
I thought it would be cool to like bring the merch table back.
That's
And
great.
I tried, and that was, you know, we talk about like iteration a bit of like you
Sure.
try something and it works or it doesn't work. So you pivot and try something else. And that's
Yeah.
kind of how Sunshine came to be, was that my idea around the merch table didn't really work out.
Okay.
And I like put out some clothes, some apparel, and yeah, like friends and family supported it. It was fine. We sold a few things, but nothing like, nothing really saying you should invest like a lot more time into this. Like,
Sure.
and then we had a moment where we tried to do a booth at the USC campus on their yoga day. They had like a annual yoga day. We set up this big booth, spent a few thousand dollars setting it up. And it was like, the sales were so bad. It was like a total flop. We're like, okay,
Oh, geez.
we
Okay.
won't do, we won't do that again.
Sure.
But
Yeah.
instead of giving up, I just thought, okay, if it's, so it's not this, like this doesn't work. So let's
Right.
try something else.
Right.
And then, so we tried partnering with, at the time would be like, I guess, influencers, people with like a high follower count and a pretty dedicated audience.
Yeah.
And I would do some cold outreach and I would say, hey, like I heard, you know, I think you'd be into what we're doing. Can we send you some merch? And maybe, you know, kind of cross your fingers that they post about it in their story or something and
Sure.
see how that goes. And so we did that. And the woman that we first sent some merch to posted in her story. And it led to like more sales in one weekend than we had gotten in like a whole year. So that
Sure,
was like
sure.
that was like the traction moment where I was like, oh shoot, okay, there's something here. We should probably double down on that.
Right.
And then I waited a little while and I tried to do it again. I thought, hey, like, can we send you some more merch?
Right.
And then her name's Gabby Abreu, and she is one of our first creators we worked with on the shop. And she said, you know what? Feels kind of like weird to just like take, like be paid to promote the products. I don't know if my audience really loves that. Why don't we just like make some merch together? Like, would you make something like custom for me? And I was like,
Sure.
I never really thought of that. But
Right.
like, clearly my stuff is not really working. So maybe hers, like maybe there's something here in this, like, in this like collab kind of thing.
Sure, yeah.
And then we made the first sort of collection of merch for her, and that led to like, you know, anything like apparel based to like ebooks and other stuff, prints as well. And
Right.
that collection did incredibly well and still does. And then that's when it, you know, again, another light bulb moment was like, oh, I think now we have like a scalable, like replicatable sort
Yeah.
of process.
Sure.
And if I'm doing, you know, I don't know, 500 sales a year with this one creator with her merch
Right.
line, what if we add another one and another one and another
Right.
one? And it was like having this vision of like, you know, by 2025, maybe we could have like 50 artists and creators in our shop
Sure.
and, you know, be doing that. Could we be doing that volume with maybe not all of them, but if we did with five of them? And that in a way, it started to feel a bit like record label style, where it's like you
Yeah.
take little bets on artists or creators
Sure.
and you work with them on something, and it doesn't always pan out, but every once in a while you strike, you kind of strike gold with one and the sales just go crazy, and
Yeah.
it kind of makes it all worth it. So that, and I think being someone who likes to create and make things,
Yeah.
the shop is a good place for me to just put my stuff as well. Like I've got the Monk record in there. It's maybe a bit of an odd fit, but it's, you know, it's still there. It's still part of me and my creative output.
Right.
And if I ever need to, you know, sell tickets for an event or want to publish a book or whatnot, I have this whole like thing that's already set up where I can
Right,
just
right, right.
plug in, and I run all of it. It's actually not on Shopify. It's on a smaller platform called WooCommerce, which is a WordPress thing. And I did that because I wanted full creative control over like everything we did. And
Yeah.
I've heard, I love Shopify as a platform, but I've heard some stories of them like messing with people's transactions or like not liking what a certain store was doing, like maybe the
Oh, sure.
contents, you know,
Right,
stuff
right,
like
right,
that.
right.
And not that we have anything too crazy on the store, but I just thought I want to have like no limits to the creativity. And If we want to put out a shirt that has, I don't know, like a swear word on it or I don't know, something risky, then
right.
nobody can say like, we're taking your store down and you're screwed.
Fantastic. So it basically became sort of like a creative agency for apparel, but also for a bunch of different products. Great.
What I say is we're in the business of like helping creators monetize their audience with apparel, essentially.
Yeah.
I think that's really cool because I think much like I was able to avoid getting a real job when I was, in my college days, what I see in creators who use social media to make a living is that like, they're basically doing the same. They're trying to avoid getting a 9-to-5 with like, their Patreons and their books and other offerings. And it's fun to be a part of that. And I'm starting to see the themes as I'm, thinking about it more, where when it came to music, I was kind of a good like curator, organizer, like the person who kind of put it all together. Yeah. And then it's almost like the same thing has happened with the shop where I was like, my creativity has its limitations. And there's a lot of people who are like much more creative and I admire them and I want to help them get their stuff out to the world. And that makes me happy.
Yeah. I take the very same approach with eights and all that stuff. Let's talk about Monk. Sort of the main thing here that I wanted to speak to, and obviously it's part of the music business, part of music industry. Where did that spark come from? Because it had been a while, right? It was sort of designed for a long time for you, and it still is.
Yeah.
But where did that spark to sort of reignite the project come from?
I'd been wanting to start a new music project pretty much since my old band broke up, and I always had trouble. getting people together to make it happen. Like I'd have a bit of a vision, and I don't know if we all just got older and more busy, and it's hard to make that time to like rehearse every week. And everyone also like it's hard until like it was hard until I kind of had songs already done, and then people started showing up. Right? It was like Then all my old friends were willing to come and play. And I was like, oh, I should have done this a long time ago.
Right.
And I think the pandemic was a big sort of like reset for me in the way that I think for a lot of people, where I thought, we're doing all this career stuff. We're working so hard. And what are we doing it all for? Maybe it'd be good to get back to some of those like hobbies you had when you were younger. And, those being skateboarding and music and kind of wondering why did I stop doing that? Like I feel like a piece of me is missing a little bit, that I don't have that outlet.
Right.
And it also coincided with working at Headspace, and our like main founder at Headspace is this guy, Andy Puddicombe. He was actually a monk in Tibet in the Buddhist tradition for about 10 years. And I got to know him pretty well just through work and working with him. And I kind of had this idea. I've always been big on like conceptual stuff, putting two things together that don't really belong.
Sure.
And trying to make something interesting. And so I thought, oh, that'd be kind of cool. Like, what if you made like hardcore and punk music that was like thematically around like something so positive as like mindfulness? And, we have a song called Nothing Matters, and it's like, I've heard from a lot of people, they're like, oh, I thought you guys were like a nihilistic punk band. But like, as I listened to the lyrics, like it's actually like the opposite, where it was more around like, more about like letting go and like finding peace with things. And like, so I have fun playing with that. And that was kind of the inspiration. And also like that I don't work at Headspace has such a big part of my life. I wanted to keep something sort of active in that world of, in that world of mindfulness that I so enjoyed at the time, because I knew the job wouldn't last forever. So I thought, let's at least like get a hobby, get an outlet that is related to that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
in regards to just the creative process, how was that for you? Because you said it yourself in regards to, and I've seen it myself as well, in regards to like getting people together without necessarily having the material is harder because there's a lot of time that needs to be spent creating the music.
Yeah.
How was that process for you, and how did it differentiate from, you know, being in a band and being in that garage or that dance studio with your friends?
It was so different. It was, I worked with two brothers, Dan and Ian Romano. You know, of their own Canadian sure. music fame.
Yeah.
And this was like mid pandemic. They were doing a lot of like session work or like recording, you know, drum tracks or guitar tracks for people, because they're, they're active touring musicians and they were looking to stay afloat during the pandemic. And I just, you know, one night shot Ian a text and he's on drums. And I said, hey, do you guys ever, you and Dan ever write like hardcore songs anymore? Cause you know, we have such a long history of that. And even though they write pretty much like rock and roll and country music these days, they still have that, you know, that, that at their core.
Yeah.
And Ian was like, yeah, we love writing that stuff. We do all, we jam it all the time and whatever. And I was like, well, I've got an idea. What if, you know, what if instead of just having, you know, having you do like session work, or like record a track, what if, you know, could we come to an agreement where we kind of start this project and we can write together? Cause I also like, I've got a folder full of riffs and lyrics, but I don't have like structured songs. So like, basically here's a playlist, here's a mood board, here's a whack load of freaking riffs, like can you guys do something with this?
Yeah.
And we chatted and it was very much like an art project or like a design project.
Yeah.
And I gave them some ideas of like titles and names I was playing with and inspiration, and very unique way to make a music project. But I have learned that it does happen more than you think, where people come on just for the project. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's all done like in another studio in another country.
Totally.
It's like, you know, or it's written here and then somebody puts bass on it in Europe and then it comes back to you. And was that process? Because I know they're based here in Ontario. So they sort of created the music and then sent it back to you and you sang sort of on it?
Exactly. Yep. Exactly. That's how
fantastic.
It works. And then the band, you know, we'd never rehearsed, we'd never played live, but we had a record coming out. And it all sort of domino effect started to happen. And I do think one, like the guys wrote really good songs, but I think the packaging and the like sort of sense of having it all be like together and like a good a story that made sense to people, it was something that I could go out and start pitching to different labels and try to get the ball rolling even more.
Yeah. Have you played with the Romano Brothers live yet for the project?
No, never. No.
No.
No, we talk about it. I think like they're so busy with their own music stuff.
Yeah.
They're on the road like 8-10 months a year. It's been fun. When we played some gigs in Ontario, Ian came out to the show and our friend Steph Duchesne, friend in common.
Yeah.
Steph was playing drums with us, and that night he was like, "Oh man, do I really have to play Ian's songs in front of Ian?" Ian's such a monster on the kit; like he's an incredible drummer. Steph, it was pretty funny to see that. But it has had like a bit of a shifting lineup as well.
Yes,
and I think that is a trend I'm seeing in the music industry, where like it's a lot less about this like set band of four or five people all the time. And it's kind of like people who are interested in the project, maybe not like married to it forever, but who's available and what sounds like fun and convenient at the time. We just kind of adapt to what's needed.
Yeah. And for you leading that project, you're always, obviously you're always there, and it's almost like a front person situation.
Yeah.
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 How important for you was it to have that like Northern Ontario band with you first? Like, was it timely or location based, or was it really like very intentional?
Well, the record was coming out and I didn't know when we would play next or play first for that matter.
Sure.
And just so happened I was heading up to Toronto for my sister was getting married, so we were going to be spending some time there, and I had the songs, the songs were ready. I had shared them with some friends, and so I thought, maybe we could get a couple rehearsals in and play, play a show or whatever. And so then I connected with some of my old musical community, and I haven't had a lot of time to get into that in California. Like I have been more recently, but a couple of years ago, I did not really have that community here. So my whole music existence was kind of like left in Ontario. And so yeah, Tom York and Sandro Sanchioni on drums, and we had our friend Brady on bass, and we all got together and we played. We set up a show at the Townhouse in Sudbury. That was our first show, and then one thing led to another. It was like, well, why don't we do Saturday in Toronto and Sunday in Montreal? And so that became a little weekend run, and I think it was cool that the first show was in Sudbury. Was like not like this grand plan that I had, but just sort of worked out that way. And had we not done it, the record would have come out and we wouldn't have really been able to play for a while. So I'm really glad we did. And now, now we've had a few tours with different lineups of people in different areas.
Fantastic. You talked about sort of pitching the album to a bunch of different people. I just wanted to ask just quickly about the Dynalone Records connection. Of course, label based here. And just wanted to ask you how that came about. Was it a previous connection from your Ontarian past? Was it through the Romano Brothers? How did that sort of play out?
Yeah, I mean, in Vicious Cycle, we were really, really close to signing to Dynalone about whatever that was, 12, 13 years ago, maybe more. And like I said, the band kind of fizzled out, and that felt like an unwritten chapter. And I was like, man, I wonder what would have happened. And they were talking about getting us to support some of their pretty big artists on tours, and it just kind of felt like this missed opportunity in my life, the kind of things that keep you up, things that keep you up at night. And you're like, man, well, it could have been. And we were in talks with some other smaller labels. And again, like my whole music community is in Canada, is in Ontario. So even though we're like an LA band, I just sort of, was, what's the expression? Like you're rubbing two pennies together, like trying to make a dollar kind of thing. Like I was just doing using what contacts I still had. And one of the guy who's actually a graphic designer at Dynalone is just a contact of mine over the years, and we've chatted about just design stuff, and he does all their artwork and runs the website and stuff like that. And he saw that I had something new going, and I honestly thought they would be a little bit too big, and I was aiming more for like a smaller kind of DIY situation. And I also felt very like unproven, like we had nothing other than the songs. And I sent him a Dropbox link because he asked for it, and I thought, you know what, maybe it's time, this is like the time to shoot my shot, and I go, okay, well, if you don't mind sharing it with the team, I'd be curious to hear what they think. And a couple of days later, I had a call with one of their VPs and just felt like the things were just going really, really fast, and felt like I actually had a team of people who were willing to support the project. And I hear a lot of bad stories about bands getting screwed by record labels, et cetera. And I think you got to read the contract, know what you're signing up for. This is music and it's fun, but it also is business, and don't be shy to negotiate. And when we were working with them, there were some terms in the contract where I thought, like, I don't really like that part. Like, what about instead of 20%, 10%? And they were like, okay, sure, sounds good. Okay. I was like, wow, that was easy.
Exactly. Wow.
You can do that. It's not like you don't have a gun to your head and you don't have to sign anything you don't want to sign. And
Yes. And typically labels sort of bet on that in regards to like being shy about not speaking up and not negotiating. So yeah, totally.
Totally. And I'm a working professional. I've done salary negotiations. I've, you know, I've had to do that in my life, much higher stakes scenarios. So this almost felt like, it I'll share a story when we were chatting with Dynalone, and they're like such fantastic people, love them. And their like artist relations person sent me a Word document to like to sign, and I was like, what is this garbage? Like I copied it and I put it into Google Docs, and I sent her the link back, and I was like, listen, let's talk through this thing live. Like, I was leaving
Yeah.
comments, like, like I
Sure.
do in my day job.
Sure,
I'm not
sure,
gonna
sure.
print out this
Yeah.
Word document and
Want
scan
me
it
to send
back.
it by mail?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And honestly, it kind of wowed them. She came back and
Wow.
she was like, wow, I wish all artists worked as quick as you, And I was like, man, like, yeah,
Yeah.
there's
Sure.
even a label at that level, is still doing things pretty old school in that way. And
Yeah. And you sort of like to see it, in a way. It's like
yeah. Right.
it's
Great.
homey in a way. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah. But yeah, it was all done in Google Docs, and no big signing the contract in the back
Yeah.
room, in the green room moment
Yeah.
or anything. But
The horseshoe tavern or something like that.
yeah,
Yeah.
exactly.
Fantastic. And that sort of relationship is still like fruitful. Are you guys talking? Is it because basically what I'm used to seeing is bands signing and then sort of going off on
Right.
tours for months and stuff. And
Right.
your priority isn't necessarily that. Like how were those discussions and how are you sort of framing that relationship and just
Yeah.
honestly like the your relationship with the project as well.
Well, I think it was important to be upfront in the beginning of like, what are the
Sure.
expectations of this thing? And
Yeah.
I try to take as little money as possible from them
Yeah.
because I know that it's essentially a loan I have to pay back at some point. So what was important to me was distribution and
Yeah.
also just being part of a group, a club of people and like-minded
Sure.
artists. And like, there's an ego aspect for sure of like, oh, you're on this like cool label with these big artists. Like that feels nice,
Sure.
It's a
Yeah. Of
good
course.
feeling. And
It's a bump also for the record as well.
totally. Yeah. And they work in this world every day. And I
Yes,
thought of
no.
it as a learning experience too, where I was like, yeah, I can go through like the cycle of a record release, and then maybe I can learn as much as possible, and then maybe I could do it on my own next time,
Sure, yeah.
So we did agree to like a set number of songs. That was one of the negotiations, was I didn't commit to any full length records. I just committed to 20 songs and
Sure, yeah.
could release those in whatever way and manner and timeline that I want.
Right.
But also it was like, listen, guys, I'm not about to quit my full-time job. I'm a dad.
Yeah.
I make a great living working at Instagram, and I'm not about to jump into the music industry full-time.
Yeah, sure.
So let's like, it's kind of a win-win for everybody. You guys don't need to dish out a bunch of money. I'm not going to be begging you for it,
Yeah.
and I will take it at my own pace.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. Let's move on now to the last segment here. It's the Dreamfest game. The infamous Dreamfest game. For those who are listening, we play a couple sort of wrap-up games here on the podcast. And this week I wanted to do the Dreamfest game with Frank. It's basically a game where I ask the guests to basically promote their own festival and program their own festival or one night of a festival. And I thought it was a good time to ask Frank these questions because he used to be a concert promoter. So, Frank, let me hear you on these Dreamfest games. And for those listening as well, I ask who the headliner would be, who the second
Sure.
headliner slash second opener would be, the opener, where the concert would happen, when it would happen, as in the time of year, the
Yep.
capacity, and how Frank
Sure.
would promote it, basically. So Frank, please go ahead on the on that.
Sure. Okay. So it's gonna be in Sudbury, Ontario, my hometown. It's gonna
Yes.
be at it's gonna be at the Jubilee Center, where I
Yeah.
booked many of my all ages shows.
Fantastic.
We will make it an all ages show with a little bar. We'll have a bar this time because that's nice to have.
Yeah.
And I would say that's about a what, 300 cap room, maybe
Sure.
250, 300. So
Yeah.
nice, still intimate, but like with a nice stage, like a tall enough stage.
Yeah. What about the time of year?
Time of year has got to be, initially I thought summer, but like Northern Ontario is dead in the summer because everyone's at their camp.
Yes.
So let's make it a spring. Let's do a spring thing.
I love it.
Like we're all coming out of hibernation.
Yeah.
Coming out of hibernation. And
now the lineup.
Yeah. The lineup. Oh, yeah. It's so tough.
Big questions. Yeah.
I'm just going to pick a really random, diverse lineup because I think that makes the most fun shows.
Yeah.
And I'll filter this by bands that had an effect on me that I know most of the lyrics to all their songs.
So
we'll have Dan Romano. He'll open it up and he'll play his country stuff.
Okay, great.
So it'll be country era.
Yeah.
And what do we have? We have and then two more than a headliner.
Four is fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Four is fine.
Yeah.
Okay. Then we're actually going to jump into, we're going to have Statues from Sudbury.
Oh,
they'll do a reunion.
Yeah.
Okay, they'll be second up. So the night's getting like a little louder as we progress. And then third up, we're going to throw something really random in. This band called Dead Stop from Belgium that probably no one knows, but had a huge effect on me when I was younger. So Dead Stop's going to come back and they're going to play.
Great.
And then we'll wrap it up with, we'll go with my label mates and we'll have Alexis on Fire and the night. And, you know, it's
fantastic.
It's probably the band I've seen the most times in my life. And we got a chance to tour with them in Vicious Cycle. And it was always funny to play to their crowds with like a punk band, but they're just so fun and the nicest people. And I think Canadian music legends, and it'd be really fun to see them. They're one of the bands I wished I was able to book when at that time. And I never did.
Yeah.
I never did. I booked some of their side projects, but never them. So that would be a nice like feather in the cap moment for me. And how I would promote it. I would do, if the show was happening on the Saturday, I would set up like a very secretive sort of merch drop style thing, the week before.
Yeah.
And tickets would be available and sell out in like 5 minutes on the Friday. and that's it.
That's
easy.
Fantastic. And just one last question. Any idea on the poster? What the poster could look like?
Oh yeah. I think for that one, I don't know that I'd want to make the poster myself.
Okay.
I would probably get the guys at Double Knot, amazing illustration studio in Toronto, to make the poster because their stuff is always incredible. And that poster would live in my house on the wall forever.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, what a dream fest game. I can't wait for spring 2025.
Let's do it.
Fantastic. Well, Frank, that's how we wrap it up. Thanks so much for coming on. And it was so great to talk to you. And honestly, we hadn't really talked that much before.
Of course.
So it was great. And to get to know both Monk, but also the whole design, your whole design career and your journey through that from Sudbury to LA.
Totally. Thank you, Matt. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you. For those listening, make sure to check out his socials at zen.daddy, at monk.losangeles and at sunshineshop.la for all the things that you've been hearing about on the podcast. Also want to just thank you for listening. This is the 62nd episode of the Cloud Machine Podcast. We like to keep this platform as interactive as it can be. So please leave your comments, your questions, your reviews below as well, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts. Please don't hesitate to subscribe. So there you go. As always, people, stay safe and we'll see you next week. Thanks, everybody. Bye.